Compounding the problem for the Army, however, was the fact that the Marines had banned Confederate symbols months earlier. I was determined to take the Confederate symbols issue on, but if I did so right now, and the president fired me, then I wouldn't be around to ensure Vindman's name was on the promotion list. And with his promotion on a tight timeline, we had to stand up for Vindman in order to keep politics out of our assignment and promotion boards. Otherwise, it would harm the military as an institution, affecting the troops' confidence in the system and their leaders. I had to keep reassuring McCarthy and McConville that we were going to do the right thing, but Vindman's promotion had to go first. It took the Army Inspector General a little over 2 months to complete the first inquiry and to determine the NSC's claims didn't warrant taking Vindman's name off the promotion list. I informed Mark Meadows, the White House Chief of Staff, that we were moving forward with the promotion, which didn't go over well with him. Meadows did not want Vindman promoted, period. But he also didn't want the White House to own the decision. He wanted me to exclude Vindman's name from the promotion list. I told him I wasn't going to do that unless the process somehow determined Vindman did something wrong. At the end of the day, the White House also had the ability to remove a name from the promotion list. The president, after all, was the commander-in-chief. I argued strenuously against doing so, however. Meanwhile, Meadows kept pressing the NSC to produce a witness, which they eventually did. The single witness presented to the Army in June was a colleague of Vindman's at the NSC. At some point in 2019, they apparently engaged in a workplace argument. Ryan McCarthy told me secondhand that when the civilian NSC staffer moved to leave the room they were in, Vindman went to the door and stood in front of it. He was apparently blocking his colleague's exit, saying that they should stay in the room and work out their issues, according to McCarthy, rather than allow the matter to fester. There was no physical altercation. Vindman never threatened the individual, and the two continued working together for months following the episode, McCarthy said. A news outlet reported the incident as an allegation by the NSC that Vindman had been verbally abusive to a colleague with whom he shared office space, and that the DOD's inquiry found that the two had gotten into an argument, but that it was a minor spat, and that they continued to work together afterward. But this incident became the basis for a misconduct allegation against Vindman. To further complicate the inquiry, the NSC denied the Army access to the staffer involved in the alleged incident. With only one allegation, no witnesses, and both sides largely agreeing on the facts, the Army disposed of the matter quickly in Vindman's favor. Meadows called me around 6:15 p.m. on Monday, July 6th, a week or so after our earlier conversation about Vindman. I had a busy day working issues ranging from anti-submarine warfare systems to our footprint in the Western Pacific, and I had been prepping for a hearing with the House Armed Services Committee, but I had managed to leave the office at 6. I was in my car with my security team when he called. Meadows first raised with me a news story about a Confederate flag memo that the Office of the Secretary of Defense was staffing, i.e. sending around for coordination, in the Pentagon. Uh-oh. But as we pulled into my driveway in Northern Virginia, the conversation pivoted to Vindman. Meadows asked, "What is the status of the Army's investigation of Vindman?" I told him it was done. Vindman was cleared, and that I will be sending over to the White House the promotion board results with Vindman's name on it in the next 24 hours or so. I had approved Vindman's inclusion on the board packet earlier that day after a final conversation with McCarthy. Meadows erupted. In a high pitch, he shouted, "Why didn't you tell me first? How could the Army get this done so quickly? Did the Army speak with other witnesses?" We were quickly yelling at each other on the phone as my black Suburban now sat parked in my driveway. The place where I used to play basketball with my daughter was hosting a showdown with the White House Chief of Staff. This was a far different game of one-on-one. I told Meadows, yes, the Army was done. The NSC only presented one witness, circumscribed the inquiry, and could produce nothing else. "Then why didn't you call me, Secretary? I would have had them get you something," he shouted. His comment was nefarious. "This has gone on for months. There's nothing," I barked back, adding, "I can't just pull Vindman's name off the list." Meadows pushed back hard that indeed I could, that I had the legal authority. He was right, of course, but he completely missed my point. I did have the legal authority, but I couldn't do it because it wasn't the right thing to do. Meadows and I were talking past each other again, but it gave me great insight into him. He asked for another week or so for him to drum up more witnesses, his tone now more of a plea than a demand. I simply said, "No, we're done." This incensed Meadows. He tried to interrupt me. I shouted over him that we were nearly out of time to get the packet to the Senate. I was going to send it to the White House this week so that his staff had a few days to process it and get it to Capitol Hill. "If you don't want him on the list, then you should remove him, but I don't support it. It would be the wrong thing to do," I yelled into the phone. Meadows shouted back, "He'll never get promoted." With that, the phone call ended. I climbed out of the car and walked into my house. Another great day at the office. Meadows phoned me at home about 45 minutes later. I figured this was the call to inform me that the president was finally firing me. As I told my wife, Leah, at the time, I was fine if that was the case. She agreed. This was a respectable issue to get canned over. But that didn't happen. Meadows said he had Eisenberg and one other lawyer in his office with him. He accused the Army of conducting an inadequate investigation and then asked if they could all meet the next day to have the Army brief them on their inquiry. I told him I would check with my general counsel, and if that was allowed, then I didn't have a problem with it. But I reminded him of my decision and my timeline. My team agreed that a meeting with NSC Legal and Meadows was permissible, so we decided to send McCarthy along with Lieutenant General Chuck Peed, a military lawyer who was the Judge Advocate General of the Army. Peed was the Army JAG when I was Secretary of the Army, so I knew and trusted him as an honest and capable officer who wouldn't yield to pressure. Also joining them was Major General Ed Jackson, the lead investigator. McCarthy was a little frustrated when I first told him that night what I needed him to do, but understood better after I gave him an account of my call with Meadows. I told him that I had confidence in their efforts and their inquiry, that I had approved the list with Vindman on it, and that all he had to do was stand firm in the meeting. We were on the right side of this issue. McCarthy and team went in the next day and indeed held firm. They gave a thorough accounting of their efforts over the previous months, what their inquiry had and had not discovered, and what they were bound to do under the law and regulation. The Army team came out of the meeting unscathed. I heard later that one of the White House lawyers told Meadows that if he pressed too hard, the Army could accuse him of tampering with an investigation, which apparently helped back him off. I was going to send the paperwork over later that day, but the Army still hadn't shared the diversity statistics that I began asking of all colonel and above promotion boards only a few weeks before, in the wake of the diversity initiatives I wanted to pursue. We had that information by Wednesday morning, July 8th. I reviewed it, and then directed my staff to send the Army Colonel Promotion Board packet with Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman's name included to the White House. Around noon that day, I saw the announcement that Vindman was retiring. I was dumbfounded. We didn't see this coming. I had been asking McCarthy about Vindman's personal status for months. He told me that despite all that was happening, Vindman was holding up fine and was looking forward to the War College. McCarthy hadn't met with him, which was the right thing to do when an investigation is underway and you're in the chain of command. But McConville, the Army's most senior uniformed leader, had, and there was another general officer checking in on him regularly. Vindman was getting a lot of top-level attention and seemed to be doing okay. Just a few weeks earlier, in June, he received a formal update regarding his orders to move to Carlisle for the War College. At some point much later, Vindman reportedly made public statements that had some of us scratching our heads. One comment that didn't jibe with what the Army's senior leaders told me was Vindman's remark that, "At no point did any senior leader, civilian or military, attempt to contact me and indicate that I still was in good standing in the military." He also told CNN, "In certain ways, they probably have misrepresented the Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of Defense Esper, probably misrepresented the amount of support I was receiving." This, too, was curious. The fact is, I don't ever recall making any statements about the amount of support he was receiving, only about my commitment that we would protect him from retribution. which in the end I felt we did to the best of our ability with our support for his highly regarded follow-on assignment and promotion. I was never briefed on why Vindman decided to retire when he did. There was some speculation that he felt pressure to act because of the impact his case was having on others caught in the fray. On July 2, 2020, Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat from Illinois, had announced that she would block Senate confirmation of over 1,100 military promotions until she received written confirmation that Vindman's promotion wouldn't be stymied. In my view, it was hypocritical for Duckworth to demand Trump not play politics with promotions by playing politics with promotions herself through the taking of innocent hostages. The fact was, the only person at that point who had held up a promotion was her, more than 1,100 of them, no less. It was at this point in the election season when Democrats were auditioning to become Joe Biden's vice president. Duckworth was as eager as Elizabeth Warren and others to show that she had the attack dog bona fides that are often sought in vice president candidates. In keeping with her partisan approach, she said after Vindman announced his retirement that the failure to protect him sets a new, dark precedent that any commander-in-chief can interfere with routine, merit-based military promotions to carry out personal vendettas and retaliation against military officers who follow duly authorized subpoenas while upholding their oath of office. This was a false statement, of course. The DOD protected Vindman's promotion. Not only that, but he was also being sent to the War College. No new precedent was set either. What was puzzling was that she made this statement after Vindman announced his retirement and after it became public that his name was on the list. The race for vice president was still ongoing, of course. A week after Vindman announced his retirement, Duckworth lifted her hold on the promotions. She claimed that she received written confirmation that Vindman was on the promotion list sent to the White House. I never sent her a letter. I don't know who, if anyone, did. It was wrong for the White House to play politics when it came to military personnel matters, but it was also wrong for members of Congress to do so. We saw this too often. The Vindman promotion and the removal of Captain Brett Crozier as commander of the USS Theodore Roosevelt were the most notable examples. In each case, a few members of Congress would make public comments about matters they had little information about, except, it seemed, what they heard from the media, simply to score political points with their constituents or to advance their own cause. I worked in D.C. long enough to understand that is often the nature of politics, but it goes too far when it's done at the expense of serving military personnel or the institution itself. Those few on Capitol Hill or in the media who did this would be proven wrong in these cases when the dust finally settled, but I cannot ever recall there being any accountability for what they said and the harm it caused. When it comes to military personnel matters, nominations, promotions, assignments, and other personnel matters, Congress should address concerns and issues that come before them behind closed doors, to get to the facts and consider all the issues first before talking to the press. I was always impressed by how Senator Jim Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Senator Jack Reed, Democrat from Rhode Island, the committee's ranking member, managed the nomination of a senior officer accused of sexual misconduct by a former subordinate. Despite an electrified political environment over this issue, the committee took its deliberations behind closed doors, did their due diligence over a period of weeks, dismissed the allegations in bipartisan fashion, and approved the officer's nomination. I was disappointed that Vindman decided to retire, but respected his decision. The Army as an institution was going to treat him fairly, but he had been through the D.C. ringer like few others. Regrettably, this made him and his family innocent casualties of this whole sordid affair. The entire Vindman saga revealed another area, military promotions, where we had to be on guard for possible meddling by the White House. Once the president named John McEntee director of the Office of Presidential Personnel in February 2020, we had to be doubly careful. McEntee had served on the Trump campaign and became his body man, akin to what the military would call an aide-de-camp, after the election. According to media reports, McEntee was fired in March 2018 after being unable to obtain a security clearance. He returned to the White House 2 years later in his new role as head of presidential personnel, reporting directly to the president, which didn't go over well with either of Trump's chiefs of staff. McEntee was clearly unqualified for the job, but his blind loyalty was likely what attracted him to Trump. McEntee would not be the first hardcore loyalist to rejoin Team Trump. After the Senate acquitted the president on both impeachment articles in February, more true believers, fresh troops like Rick Grenell and Mark Meadows, began entering the White House. They paired up with the likes of Robert O'Brien, Stephen Miller, and Kash Patel, the senior director for counterterrorism at the NSC, to do Trump's bidding. A darker, more aggressive evolution of the Trump White House was now emerging. McEntee jumped off to a quick start in his new role by simultaneously moving to install like-minded loyalists in the cabinet department's liaison offices, those teams responsible to the White House for personnel actions, and scrutinizing the statements and actions of current political appointees. All the departments were affected, but my sense was that Homeland Security and State had it the toughest. Even Housing and Urban Development wasn't immune to McEntee's tactics, with Secretary Ben Carson's White House notes on this matter photographed once by the media. The captured talking point for his meeting with the president said, "I am not happy with the way PPO, the presidential personnel office that McEntee headed, is handling my agency." Soon enough, loyalty purges morphed into a weapon that White House staffers wielded to get rid of people in the departments who disagreed with anything they said, even if they were aligned with the president's policies. John Rood at the DOD was a case in point. He supported Trump's national security agenda, but pushed back at times against some of the more unreasonable ideas coming out of the NSC. This was a main reason he was pushed out, I later learned. Despite my vocal support, others were denied well-earned promotions, such as the highly qualified Elaine McCusker, who challenged the Office of Management and Budget's decision to hold up the funding for Ukraine, to be the DOD comptroller, and the equally capable Katie Wheelbarger, whose supposed sin was once working for Senator John McCain, to become the deputy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, OSD, Intelligence and Security Directorate. Worse yet, people were removed from positions simply because the White House wanted to replace them with more hardcore Trump loyalists, regardless of their qualifications. Tony Tata, for example, was identified to replace Rood as the head of the Pentagon's policy office. This was also what happened after my departure when they fired James Anderson, forced Joe Kernan, a retired vice admiral and former Navy SEAL commander who was serving as the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security, to resign, and targeted others before reportedly being urged to stop by GOP lawmakers such as Senator Mitch McConnell. My strategy for dealing with presidential personnel was like a game of chess. Don't surrender any pieces easily, but do everything you can to save your most important ones. You have to pick your battles. When it came to political appointees, it was clearly the president's prerogative to decide who would or would not serve in his administration. Where I drew a hard line was the presidential personnel office's attempts to go after career civilians and uniformed officers. This happened on a few occasions after McEntee installed his people at the Pentagon in October 2020. It was these new loyalists who would eventually implement the orders to remove Anderson and others, and then proceed to purge the defense policy and defense business boards. As if going after current people wasn't good enough, Trump's loyalists once tried to recall retired four-star officers back to active duty to court-martial them for criticizing the president. In early May 2020, stories appeared in outlets like Breitbart that alleged retired Army General Stan McChrystal was advising Democrats on ways to use AI to track down and counter Trump supporters on social media. This spun the president up. It wasn't the first time McChrystal was on the wrong side of Trump, though. But this latest report struck a nerve, even though McChrystal had not endorsed former Vice President Joe Biden, and later told another media outlet that his interest in advising a Democrat-aligned PAC was about ensuring the accuracy of information leading up to the election. The next thing I knew, Mark Milley and I were sitting in front of the president trying to talk him out of recalling McChrystal to active duty. To make matters worse, by the time we had arrived at the White House, someone in the Oval Office had thrown retired Navy Admiral William H. McRaven, the commander who organized the raid to kill Osama bin Laden, onto the bonfire. McRaven had also written things critical of Trump in the past. The president told Milley and me that he wanted to call them, McChrystal and McRaven, back to active duty and court-martial them for what they said. "So disloyal," he would say. Milley and I jumped to their defense, arguing that both are distinguished officers, and that taking such an action was extreme and unwarranted. "Doing this will backfire on you, Mr. President," we said. The discussion went back and forth a little while longer in the Oval Office, with Milley finally figuring out a way to get the president to back down by promising that he would personally call the officers and ask them to dial it back. At another point, the White House Liaison Office, WHLO, in the Pentagon expressed an interest in interviewing the DOD's senior officers, which we saw as code for loyalty tests. We shut this down immediately. The process to appoint an officer to a four-star joint position is a long, well-established one. It does not involve any interviews by the WHLO. Approximate transition dates are determined years in advance, and the actual selection begins at the service level at least a year out. The custom is that each service can nominate one individual for any joint assignment coming open. We kept close track of these positions, and as I went about my travels in the United States and abroad, I tried to meet with the officers the services would likely recommend for one of these jobs. It was a good way to get to know them without it being a formal interview. I would often conduct an interview process nonetheless, but I wanted to get as many interactions with the person as possible. As Jen Stewart, General Milley, and I looked at the four-star assignments opening in 2021, now less than a year away, we recognized that the process could really get squeezed if Biden was elected president and had to start from scratch. He might not have all the right people in place to conduct a deliberate and timely process, which usually took up to 6 months. Two of the first billets to open, for example, were for the command of U.S. Forces Korea and Indo-Pacific Command. I didn't want to leave the Biden team in a bind by trying to figure how best to select a half dozen officers in a few short months. I wanted to put forward my best recommendations, and they could decide from there whether to accept or reject my selectees. Conversely, if Trump was re-elected and I was no longer Secretary of Defense, I didn't want to put my successor in a fix either. As such, in October, my team presented slates of officers for six service and joint positions for me to consider, interview as necessary, and select. Because my fate beyond November 3rd was uncertain, I quickly went through each case, and with the benefit of my knowledge of the officers, the recommendations of their services and my head of personnel and readiness, and discussions with Stewart and Milley, I made my picks. I ended up choosing the replacements for Indo-Pacific Command and U.S. Forces Korea for a May transition, and Joint Special Operations Command for a July handover. U.S. Transportation Command was set for an August transfer, but because the Senate typically recessed that month, we treat it like a July change of command, meaning that we move up the timeline to ensure we give the upper chamber of Congress sufficient time to act on it. U.S. Southern Command was programmed for a November transition, but the current commander, Admiral Craig Faller, had told me he might retire early in the summer, so we accelerated that selection as well. Finally, we had to install a new vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in November 2021. We were all aware of the ongoing turmoil with the Presidential Personnel Office and its Pentagon liaison staff, having to swat down their multiple attempts to remove people and purge various defense boards. We also knew there were people on the White House staff who were constantly on the alert for anything they felt smacked of political correctness. That was the conclusion of some when I decided to remove the Confederate flag from our bases in July, and earlier when I put forward the three diversity and inclusion initiatives to deal with discrimination and bias in the ranks. Finally, there were a lot of knives out for me personally, and some of them had already been inserted by so-called colleagues through the media and with the president. As a result, the fate of my decisions and me after the election was another wild card that was trending negative. I became increasingly concerned that somehow, what most of us would consider doing the right thing, putting forward very good officers for promotions into the highest positions of the U.S. military, would get caught up in White House politics or paybacks. Given these dynamics, we knew these cases would have to be handled carefully, individually, and that the proper scouting of their receptivity at the White House was key. If I remained in office, Millie and I would probably have to walk some of them over, one at a time, to make sure we could get them through the process and to the Senate. If we sensed any resistance, then we'd have to figure out ways to get that person on board. But if the president kept me as Secretary of Defense, this would be less of a problem. The more challenging scenario was if I was fired after the election. If Trump won, then Milley et al. Could share my recommendations with the acting Secretary of Defense, and then he or she would determine what to do with them, to include restarting the entire process. If Trump lost, then Milley et al. Would have another option. If he felt that the White House might reject one, some, or all the nominees simply because I, Mark Esper, recommended these officers, then he could sit on them until the Biden team came into office. The same was true if the reaction by some was to reject nominees because they thought we were playing politics. We were concerned about this because two of the selectees were women, Army Lieutenant General Laura Richardson to be the next head of Southern Command, and Air Force General Jacqueline Van Ovost to be the future leader of Transportation Command. Both were highly qualified officers and the best picks for the job. This was not about their gender, but I was concerned that some in the White House would allege that these were woke nominations and act against them. The president removed me from office before the 6 promotion packets I approved were acted upon. I learned that somehow Ezra Cohen Watnick, the new acting undersecretary for intelligence, got his hands on the packets and allegedly tried to scrub them all for anti-Trump bias. How someone outside the chain of command and not part of the normal process gained control of these promotion packets was troubling. The joint staff was able to get them back, however, but Cohen Watnick apparently had already found a replacement for one of the officers I selected. This would have been terrible. Milley reportedly went to Acting Secretary of Defense Chris Miller and had this undone. 3 of the packets went forward while Trump was still in office, but 2 were held back. I'm not sure what happened with the 6th and final recommendation at the time, the one for the next vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, though my pick was eventually endorsed by President Biden. I am confident, though, that the Cohen-Watnick intervention further spooked folks about possible White House intervention. I was pleased to see that President Biden supported the nominations of Van Ovost and Richardson. The strategy had worked. Both officers were confirmed by the Senate in the fall of 2021. Becoming the highest-ranking women in the U.S. military, and only the 2nd and 3rd women to run a combatant command. A couple of critics later tried to claim that the withholding of these packets somehow delayed the promotion of these officers, which made no sense since the timing of our actions built enough time into the system on purpose. Moreover, there was no date stamp on these promotions, and no identified pin-on date like a traditional promotion board. Someone also wrote that holding on to these promotion packets until the Biden team arrived was politicizing the promotion process and hurt civilian-military relations. One suggestion was that we, Millie and I, should have marched these packets over to the White House and fought it out on the spot. These arguments fail to recognize that our strategy actually prevented politicization by the White House and protected the officers involved. After all, the president could have selected 2 other officers for these jobs if the White House learned these positions were opening up, effectively ending the careers of the best qualified ones that I had selected. Trump certainly did and said things that risked politicizing the military. The Gallagher case was the nadir for the DOD in this regard. That said, I would later tell folks that the Gallagher and Vindman examples were best understood as Trump pressing his thumb into a soccer ball. It's hard to do, and he can cause a small indentation for as long as he keeps his finger in place. But the moment he relents, it goes back to its original form. This is the strength of America's institutions, and especially the U.S. military. It is both strong and resilient, and the armed forces' values, ethos, rules, protocols, heritage, and most especially its oath to the Constitution guarantee that it will endure and remain apolitical. No single person, not even the commander-in-chief, can change the military's DNA. At the end of the day, as I look back over my nearly 18-month tenure as Secretary of Defense, I am confident that we didn't allow the military promotion system to be politicized. We held true to picking the best qualified officers for advancement, whether it happened through a traditional promotion board system, as it did with Vindman, or whether it transpired through the less formal process that occurs for the nation's most senior officers. The civilian and uniformed leadership at the Pentagon followed established processes, selected leaders based on performance and potential, and protected the institution and its processes from outside political influence. Chapter 18. Lost causes and important ones. Let it go. Put it in a museum. Candidate Trump uttered these words about the Confederate flag when asked by a reporter in June 2015 whether South Carolina should continue to fly it above its statehouse. 5 years later, he would embrace the opposite position, a stance that would create another flashpoint between the White House and the military. It was now mid-July 2020, and I had surprisingly survived my objection to invoking the Insurrection Act, reshaped the withdrawal of forces from Germany, scaled down the elaborate celebration planned for the 4th of July, and sent the promotion of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman to the White House. It was hard to believe. My game plan was holding. Yet we still had more issues to go. We had learned about Trump's latest view on Confederate issues the hard way, when Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy told CNN on June 8th, on background, that he and I were open to holding a bipartisan conversation about renaming bases and installations that bear the names of Confederate military leaders. It was an accurate report. We both felt strongly about this issue. It was overdue, and the outpouring of personal stories and emotion coming from the ranks in the wake of George Floyd's killing was both overwhelming and compelling. I lived or trained at some of these bases during my military career and was familiar with the other Army installations that bore the names of Confederate officers. For the most part, I didn't know much about the men after whom these bases were named, which was probably true for many military personnel who worked on or passed through them. Regardless, the common thread running through all of these Confederate leaders was that they violated their sworn oaths and took up arms against the United States. It was that simple. But changing the names of bases named after Confederate officers was also a deeply political issue that touched on matters of race, culture, history, law, and so on. I felt that it was an issue for Congress, the people's representatives, to decide. Expecting the Army to make this decision was passing the buck, because whatever decision the military made would be criticized, challenged politically, taken to the courts, or end up in Congress anyway. It also risked a great deal of drama that could damage the armed forces at a time when I was trying to keep us out of politics. So I was pleased to see language in the Fiscal Year 2021 National Defense Authorization Act that finally took this issue on in bipartisan fashion. The president reacted angrily about the report of McCarthy's comments. Meadows called me on the morning of June 9th and was upset. He demanded, "Who authorized McCarthy to say what he said?" I imagined him turning red as he barked into the phone. "Me," I said. "I approved it." All that McCarthy expressed, I said, was an openness to have a conversation with Hill leaders on the topic, as I explained our rationale. Meadows shot back, "You don't have any authority to get involved in political issues." Which wasn't true, but also wasn't worth debating at the moment. Well aware that it was still less than a week since I stood before the media in the Pentagon briefing room and rebuked the president on the Insurrection Act, I knew I was on very thin ice. Moreover, we weren't ready yet to take on Confederate basing and flags. I still had to figure out the policy and the best way to implement it. Equally important, however, was that I had a meeting scheduled at noon that same day to jumpstart my three DOD-wide diversity and inclusion initiatives. The high-profile and senseless killings of several African Americans over the previous months, punctuated by the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, exposed a festering wound in the ranks of the armed forces that many of us didn't appreciate, but should have. In the months that would follow, I conducted nearly 24 listening sessions with our service members as I traveled around U.S. military installations. I would hear the same story over and over. From all parts of the joint force, both in America and abroad, I would learn about the racism and discrimination that so many of our uniformed personnel of color and their families had experienced growing up, and in many cases, too many cases, that they were still experiencing while in uniform on base and certainly off base. This was very troubling for me to hear, but it wasn't that hard to understand given that our service members came from small towns, cities, and suburbs across America. Many had dealt with racism prior to joining the military. Some came from communities so homogeneous that a person from another race or ethnicity is largely invisible. And still others grew up in households, schools, and neighborhoods that advance all sort of negative stereotypes. Yet, despite everything that the armed services did to bring these young Americans together, to teach them a new set of values and behaviors, and to acculturate them into a merit-based system focused on our nation's security, some degree of prejudice was bound to endure in some of them. In my talks with service members, the consensus was typically that the military was doing better than American society in general, and that unconscious bias in the ranks was a bigger, more common problem than overt racism. Regardless of how one calculated or categorized this prejudice, there was much more that we needed to do. Tackling this issue wasn't solely about doing the right thing for our service members. It was also the right thing to do for the security of our nation. Ensuring diversity and inclusion was a readiness issue. We needed to recruit the best Americans to serve, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, or gender. Similarly, a soldier, sailor, airman, guardian, or marine who feels included, respected, and valued will work harder, stay longer, and fight better. My discussion that day with the Pentagon leadership was an important moment when I put the issue squarely on the table and challenged all of us to take it head on. It was just over 2 weeks since George Floyd's killing. We couldn't solve the issues of race and discrimination in American society that were playing out before us on the news, and I didn't expect Trump to try to do so, but we could confront it in the armed forces. In my view, the military had often led on these issues in the past, and it was time to do so again. I asked those gathered what else we could do to get out in front of this issue and begin solving problems. There was general agreement that we needed to look at all aspects of military service, from recruitment and accessions to promotions, schools, command boards, and assignments. We talked some about poor representation in the officer corps, Confederate flags on bases, as well as tasking the inspector general to look at discrimination in the ranks. These were good ideas, and many eventually made it into our work program, but I wanted to stay away from simply more long-term studies and reports that some recommended. My suspicion was that we had a lot of good ideas before us already. In fact, at one point, after asking to see the previous DOD studies on diversity, I was presented a stack of papers and binders that stood between 1 and 2 feet tall. I was told these reports were from previous commissions and study groups over the years. I hadn't realized we had been down this road so many times before. Most disappointing was that the department rarely implemented many of the recommendations in the various reports. This was why I wanted to focus on concrete actions we could accomplish in the coming days, weeks, and months. We went around the room so that everyone had a chance to speak, and then I wrapped up by repeating my core view. I challenged everyone to come back to me in a week with some quick actions we could implement immediately to demonstrate our seriousness and urgency. Then we needed to look at a range of issues from the symbolic to the structural and everything in between over the longer term. With that, the meeting broke up. On June 10th, Trump tweeted out, "It has been suggested that we should rename as many as 10 of our legendary military bases, such as Fort Bragg in North Carolina, Fort Hood in Texas, Fort Benning in Georgia, etc. These monumental and very powerful bases have become part of a great American heritage and a history of winning, victory, and freedom." He added, "The United States of America trained and deployed our heroes on these hallowed grounds and won 2 world wars. Therefore, my administration will not even consider the renaming of these magnificent and fabled military installations." We had spent days trying to explain to those around the president and others outside government who were close to him about the political benefits of renaming the bases, in the hope they would talk to Trump. We probably called over a half dozen folks to help us make our case. Some, like David Urban, an old friend, West Point classmate, and skilled political operator who orchestrated the president's surprise victory in Pennsylvania in 2016, made this argument more than once to the commander-in-chief. "It will be something that Obama and Biden never did," he pressed, "and allow you, Mr. President, to claim the high ground." After all, base renaming was going to be in the annual National Defense Authorization Act anyway, I believed, which meant an authority and opportunity available to him could be taken over by Congress. But most important, renaming was the right thing to do, and I wanted to help him get on the right side of the issue, where he was years before. The president's tweets on June 10th closed the door to this much-needed change, however. I didn't think Trump was well-served by the advice he was getting inside the White House. He would ask General Milley and me many times about this issue over a few months, and our response was consistent. The bases should be renamed. Meadows and I spoke again on the topic of race and discrimination in the military on the morning of June 11th. I continued to share with him the pressure the service leaders were feeling from the ranks. My ideas about a three-pronged approach were coming into focus, so I told him that one of the things I intended to do to address the challenges the military was facing was to establish an internal board with a tight timeline to study the issue, including all previous DoD reports, and task them to come back to me with implementable recommendations. I sensed he was a little reluctant, but when I said the board wouldn't report back to me until December after the election, his support shifted in my favor. On the Friday of that week, I met with the senior enlisted advisors from all the services, along with senior enlisted advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Ramon C.Z. Colon Lopez. C.Z. was a class act who took on this issue head-on. He joined me on some of my sensing sessions with the troops. Engaging with senior NCOs is always refreshing because of their candor and rich perspective from decades in the military. They gave me some good ideas as I started sharing my thoughts with them. Some of these would make it into the directive we would eventually publish. We regrouped as a leadership team the following Monday as planned. We discussed a few ideas, but nothing really big and no broader strategy. I raised a few issues that I had dealt with in the past, as both an Army officer in the 1990s and later as Secretary of the Army. I never liked the inclusion of photos on promotion boards, for example. It triggered unconscious bias, one way or the other. My concern was that people tended to gravitate to those who look like them. Ducks pick ducks, as we would often say. It seemed obvious to me to drop the photo from all promotion boards, with Milley adding that they should be removed from command selection panels as well. I was surprised by the reluctance from the Navy and the Marines, however. They thought removing pictures might lead to less diversity. Being a former service secretary, I knew how these boards worked. So I told them that using selection statistics on the back end, once the selectees were chosen but before the promotion list was finalized, was a way to cross-check and assess diversity in the ranks. After a quick discussion on this topic, I thanked everyone for their views and then told them I was going to get rid of the photos. Period. Privately, I felt that if we couldn't get agreement on something this simple, we were going to have a real challenge on our hands doing the tough things that would make a major difference. I was going to have to drive this issue hard. Over the weekend, I spent a fair amount of time thinking through this issue and some possible strategies. I sensed our opportunity to capture the energy of the moment, and everyone's singular attention was fleeting, so we had to act now. I also knew the force was watching closely what we would do. If we paused, it would not go over well, so it was important to show some quick actions to advance diversity and inclusion. At the same time, I also recognized that quick actions were often the easy ones, the low-hanging fruit that maybe didn't deliver the heavy punches we needed. We had some real systemic and structural changes that had to be made, and that would take longer than a few days or weeks. We needed an enduring focus on the issues of race, discrimination, and inclusion. This issue was too important for today's leadership alone to study and address. Moreover, regardless of what happened in November, many of us would likely move on by the summer of 2021. We might not be around to see these issues pursued, let alone implemented. The Defense Department had been dealing with issues of race and discrimination throughout its history, and had done a good job, but at some point the institution took its foot off the gas. critics would say Trump's Pentagon was all white and all male, and while it's true we could do much better, we also weren't as bad as some would allege. As Army Secretary, I had personally selected the first African-American superintendent of West Point, and later chose the first African-American to serve as Air Force Chief of Staff, and not because I was pursuing some diversity quota, but because they were the best qualified. The same was true for women, both during my time as Secretary of the Army and Secretary of Defense. We had several superb professionals at the undersecretary level, such as the head of acquisition and sustainment, the chief management officer, and the acting comptroller, and of course, my chief of staff. And at the end of my tenure, as mentioned earlier, I would select the second and third women ever to become four-star combatant commanders. As I thought through these issues more over that weekend, I came up with the following plan to address diversity and inclusion in the ranks. Charge the chain of command to come back to me in a few weeks with their recommendations for quick actions we could implement in the near term. Organize a more representative internal DOD board to come up with findings and recommendations over the midterm, meaning no later than December. And then establish a permanent outside board comprised of independent experts and thought leaders who could help us address structural, systemic, and cultural obstacles to reform. This last pillar would constitute the sustained, expert focus this issue demanded. I put my plan on the table at the next Monday morning meeting. I described my vision of three lines of effort, differentiated in time and by the composition of the groups leading them. I told my team I wanted their feedback soonest. My plan was to announce our strategy in the next week or so. I added that I would be putting a deadline of mid-July, just a month away, for the first set of changes that we would unveil to the force. This was a big task with an aggressive timeline, just over 4 weeks away, but I felt I needed to lay down a marker, inject a sense of urgency, and be able to tell Congress and the press we were leading. I also wanted to give the Army something to focus on other than Confederate flags. They were very anxious. I knew the service carried the heaviest burden on this matter, but I kept pressing them to be patient and trust that we were going to address the matter soon. I also met with the service secretaries. We always discussed a bevy of issues as a team, since so many, such as housing, healthcare, and COVID, were common to everyone. On diversity and inclusion, I repeated that this was a matter that we civilians needed to lead on. Yes, there were very big morale and readiness issues that the uniformed side was comfortable with and competent in addressing, but this is where civilian leaders, who brought far broader experiences and views to the Pentagon, were better suited, and appropriately so, to lead. I was blessed with a solid group of service secretaries. They were already there. I asked Barbara Barrett, the Air Force Secretary, to lead the second line of effort, a new defense board on diversity and inclusion in the military. Barbara was an exceptional leader in her own right, who had come to the department with a proven track record and stellar reputation in the business, academic, and public policy worlds. The temporary board she led would conduct a 6-month sprint to develop concrete, actionable recommendations to increase racial diversity and ensure equal opportunity across all ranks, especially in the officer corps. I told her the members of this board, which would be composed of service members of several ranks from each of the military departments, would have the carte blanche and resources to chart their own course until their disbandment in December. However, I didn't want to see their recommendations before November because I was concerned they would be leaked and that some in the media, the Hill, or the White House would try to politicize her work. Barbara and I also discussed the third line of effort, establishing a permanent commission to study the issues of diversity and inclusion in the force and be a ready resource for the Pentagon's leadership. I was aware of the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, DACOWITS, from my time on the Hill, and I had met with them to discuss a few issues I was trying to advance as Army Secretary, such as better policies for pregnant service members. They brought exceptional expertise and did good work over the years providing independent advice and recommendations on matters under their purview. Barbara had also been a member of DACOWITS earlier in her career. All agreed this was a good model to follow, and thus the Defense Advisory Committee on Diversity and Inclusion in the Armed Services was born as a permanent and independent body of non-DOD civilian experts to work on these issues on behalf of our service members. I was excited about this plan, and the momentum we were starting to gain in making it happen. I wanted to announce these initiatives and get them rolling before I took on Confederate flags. Therefore, on June 18th, I released a message from me to all of the DOD explaining our three initiatives, why we were pursuing them, and what we aimed to accomplish. The next day, we published a diversity and inclusion directive that integrated all three lines of effort into an action plan. Separately, I gave Matt Donovan, the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, the task of developing options to address extremism and hate group membership in the ranks, an action that would result in a series of recommendations from him that were approved in November. It was a historic moment for the department, being one of the most significant and sustained efforts to address discrimination and bias in our ranks in many years. Doing so made me glad I hadn't stepped down in June. If I had, the DOD would not have launched these initiatives. I enjoyed the brief moment of satisfaction. It was one of the few that my core team and I had these days. A heavy cloud seemed to be hanging over the DOD since June 3rd, but it never affected my ability to get things done. Most of what I did, well over 90%, was of little interest to the White House, and only the President had the authority to overrule me. As such, I did my best to continue my day-to-day work, including my weekly National Defense Strategy implementation sessions, calls with lawmakers, and engagements with my counterparts around the world. Important meetings on casualty reporting, going back to the Iranian missile attacks in January 2020, with the defense industry, on Operation Warp Speed, and about the development of Space Command, another important administration achievement, also occupied my time. This was the rewarding part of the job, and had the added benefit of being wholly consistent with my inside offense strategy. That said, I had to assume that every day was my last. I would often ask Jen Stewart, my chief of staff, what are the must-do items for today, in case I'm not here tomorrow? Or, what do I need to sign tonight before I go home for the day to advance the NDS or take care of the force? We couldn't rest. We were going to run through the tape. After months of work, for example, we published a new policy in early November regarding pregnant service members. As Army Secretary, I had learned of anecdotes about female soldiers whose careers were mishandled by the service's personnel system or their respective leaders because they were pregnant. This was an issue in the other services as well. Too often, outdated policies and procedural norms not based on medical fact meant that military women had to disrupt their assignments, forego non-combat deployments, or even relinquish leadership positions, any of which could be detrimental to their career, due to pregnancy. In this day and age, with medical advancements, far better knowledge, and full incorporation of women in the workforce, it seemed like the armed forces were behind the times. I would often raise this topic with my service secretaries, who conveyed unease and resistance from their uniformed staffs. It was clear there was more concern about liability, which was not unjustified given some past experiences, than about empowering our female service members. However, I couldn't allow overprotective, outdated assumptions about what women could and couldn't do while pregnant limit their careers, and further risk them leaving the service. We needed to be more flexible. The policy I published, among other things, did away with one-size-fits-all approaches and allowed pregnant female service members to do their jobs, even in deployed settings in the United States or abroad, if they requested it, their commander agreed, and their doctor endorsed it. No more micromanaging individual cases from the Pentagon. We had several personnel issues like these ahead of us, and I still had an Army leadership team anxious about Confederate flags. I hoped that the announcement on our diversity and inclusion initiatives, though, bought us a little more time. On June 29, 2020, we briefed the President on our plans to pull more than 11,000 troops out of Germany and reposition them in other NATO countries and the United States. After the meeting in the Oval Office, I met with Mark Meadows to go over a few other issues. General Milley was in the Germany meeting too, so I asked him to join me. We sat down in Meadows' office in the West Wing, overlooking the southwest section of the grounds. We started with some small talk, and then I raised the issue of Confederate symbols, flags, on military bases, and the increasing turbulence it was causing in the force. "This issue is most pronounced in the Army," I said. because the Marines banned the Confederate flag months earlier, and the Army feels it is playing catch-up. Moreover, I told him, the Army has several major bases named after Confederate generals, which is adding to the problem. In short, trouble was brewing in the ranks, and the uniform and civilian leaders in all the services were feeling it. General Milley helped by adding his perspective as a soldier, a general, and the leader of the Joint Chiefs. Meadows listened carefully. He put his finger to his mouth and nodded as we spoke. I knew where Meadows stood. He didn't say so, but my sense was that he saw the Confederate flag as a symbol of Southern heritage, not racism. Meadows was also acutely sensitive to anything that sounded like a cancel culture action, as he said on a couple of occasions. He surprised me, though, when he said, to be honest with you, the president would probably personally support a Confederate flag ban, but never went on to explain Trump's opposition to such things now. The answer was obvious, though. The election was a few months away, and the president didn't want to anger his base. Someone convinced him that this issue mattered to those voters, though some polling indicated otherwise. It was my sense that Meadows was pushing this logic. The chief of staff went on to say, now arguing against our recommendation, that if the military bans the Confederate flag, you will look political. I told him, this is not a political matter for us, but a morale, cohesion, and readiness issue, and not only for our African American service members. As leaders, we need to deal with this issue, I added. We were already a diverse force, probably the most diverse department in the government. But this didn't mean there weren't problems. We had more work to do. The facts were clear. In the active duty force of approximately 1.3 million personnel, 82% of all personnel are enlisted. Of these numbers, 18.9% identify themselves as Black or African American, 16.7% as Hispanic or Latino, and 4.5% as Asian American. In total, racial and ethnic minorities made up more than 43% of the U.S. military. Yet, while minorities were well represented in the enlisted ranks, reflecting American society at large, they were underrepresented in the officer ranks, particularly at the general officer level. If a sizable minority of the force didn't feel we were addressing their concerns and didn't see their leaders acknowledging them and acting, then they were going to vote with their feet. They would leave the service and were unlikely to encourage others to enlist. And whether they were planning to leave the service or not, it wasn't hard to imagine growing disgruntlement, greater disillusionment, and lower morale. This easily translates into less unit cohesion, morale, and effectiveness if allowed to fester. It was an issue we couldn't take lightly, and one we needed to get in front of quickly. General Milley and I walked Meadows through these issues. Meadows smartly left the playing field where we dominated and jumped into one where he felt more comfortable. Politics. He shared how he handled issues like this in Congress and then asked, if you ban the Confederate flag, then where does it end? Where do you draw the line? How do you keep politics out of the military? These were good points. Flags are very visible symbols, and various ones are claimed by groups and movements on the left and the right. Sometimes long-standing flags and symbols are even co-opted. I wanted none of that in our ranks or on our bases. As I considered the matter right then and there, I came up with an idea that would ultimately become our policy. I would turn the Confederate flag ban inside out. When Meadows finished, I paused for a moment, looked at him, and said, "You're right, Mark. Those are important issues that I'm concerned about as well." I added, "I have an idea. Give me a few days and I'll get back to you." With that, General Milley and I stood up and left. I returned to the Pentagon and met with my general counsel, Paul Nye, and later with Matt Donovan to discuss this alternative approach to get rid of the stars and bars and other Confederate symbols on our bases. I first spoke with Nye to get his legal read on my approach. Much like with Donovan, I had become acquainted with Nye when I was Secretary of the Army. The Senate confirmed Paul as General Counsel for the Department in July 2018. It wasn't his first tour in the Pentagon, though. He had served in other senior legal positions at the DOD in the past. So between those tours and his private experience, he brought a good deal to the role. Paul was also a good lawyer with a lot of common sense, who knew how to get an answer to a legal yes instead of a bureaucratic no, as was too often the case in the building. Paul really liked the idea I was putting forward: to keep the DOD out of politics by publishing a directive listing only the flags authorized to be flown on U.S. military bases and installations. We wouldn't ban the Confederate flag explicitly. We just wouldn't authorize it, or most any other flags, to be flown or displayed. Nye doubled down and proposed we say up front that the United States flag, the Stars and Stripes, was the principal flag we are authorized and encouraged to display, as the memo would eventually read. This really animated him. You could sense his patriotism. I liked it. If I signed out a directive affirming the American flag as our principal flag and didn't allow any others to be flown except those I approved in the directive, how could this administration or a future one overturn it? Who would oppose only flying the American flag on U.S. military bases? It was a hard issue to debate, let alone overturn, but that didn't mean some in the White House wouldn't use it against us at the Pentagon. Just the same, I asked Nye and Donovan to start drafting the directive very quietly. What I really liked about the policy approach we were taking on flags was not only that it addressed the immediate problem, removing the Confederate flag, but that it was a prospective policy that excluded any and all flags that could possibly show a hint of politics. The DOD didn't need to be in the business of deciding which flags were and were not offensive enough for the department to fly or ban. This was an important way to help keep the DOD out of politics today and going forward, and it would at least raise the bar if others in the future wanted to go in the opposite direction. The team worked hard over the next couple of weeks on the first set of quick action diversity items, and by July 14th, I had a memo entitled Immediate Actions to Address Diversity, Inclusion, and Equal Opportunity in the Military Service, prepared and signed. The directive included a number of recommendations from across the services, beginning with removing photographs from promotion boards, and other actions such as reviewing hairstyle and grooming standards to ensure they were not racially biased, assessing the effectiveness of equal opportunity offices, and training leaders to discuss and address issues of prejudice and discrimination in the ranks. The next day, I joined Barbara Barrett in launching the inaugural meeting of the Defense Board on Diversity and Inclusion. Separately, I asked Paul Nye on July 10th to reach out to Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, and share our draft flag memo with him, and to make sure Cipollone shared it with the White House Chief of Staff as well. 3 days later, Meadows emailed me to say he had a couple of edits. I asked Nye to follow up with Cipollone, which he did. Nye and I both thought the changes were fine, especially if we could build support from the White House. On July 15th, a day after at least one news outlet reported that something was in the works, Cipollone called Nye back and said that, despite the edits, he and Meadows didn't want the memo to go out yet. Moreover, they couldn't tell us if they would ever approve its release. It wasn't clear if Meadows was stringing us along, but my sense was that the game was up. The White House wasn't going to support us. I had to decide: do what is right for the armed forces and our people, or play along with the politics of the moment. I called a meeting with the service secretaries and chiefs for that same afternoon, a few hours after the first meeting of the Diversity and Inclusion Board. We met in the Nunn Lugar conference room. There was a nervous buzz around the table as I laid out my game plan. I thanked them for their support for how much we accomplished in a few short weeks on race and discrimination. I said it was time to address Confederate flags and symbols. Rather than banning the Confederate flag, we were going to take a different approach. We were only going to authorize the American flag and a few others for display on DOD bases and installations. I made clear again that this is a civilian-led policy issue, and I laid out the four key attributes of our approach. First, it would affirm the centrality of the U.S. flag to the military. Second, it would be prospective and keep political and divisive flags and symbols off our bases into the future. Third, it would be enduring, in that we had determined it could sustain any legal challenge. And finally, it was apolitical. I informed everyone that my plan was to release the flag memo on Friday without White House approval, and that I was now giving them a 2-day heads up to have their service-level memos ready to go. I didn't want any extended time gaps between my directive going out and everyone else's. I felt it important that we get them all out the same day and that we all have the same message. Jen Stewart was directed to review the service's instructions before they went out. Speed, Alignment and unity were important here to show the seriousness with which leadership took the issue, as well as the fact that we are standing together on this issue. We also couldn't afford any leaks between now and then. Once the memo was out, I told them, the OSD would handle the press and media inquiries. We would also provide them top cover so that they could stay out of the fray. With that, we went around the room one last time for any final questions, comments, or ideas before the meeting adjourned. The next 48 hours or so were tense, not knowing if someone would leak to the media or get word back to the White House. It seemed that every time the phone rang, I expected it was the call from the president ordering me to not do anything regarding the Confederate flag. His views on changing the names of bases named after Confederate generals was clear. We took it as an order. But he never said anything similar regarding Confederate flags. One could argue we were actually doing what Trump supported before becoming president. The fact was, I was still surprised that we made it this far, navigating the minefield of July 4th, Germany withdrawal, and other issues. Meanwhile, we were making good progress on our internal readiness and modernization agenda while dealing with COVID and keeping the nation safe. The inside-outside strategy was holding. How long could I survive? Friday would be telling. July 17th came without any major leaks or inquiries from the White House. Around mid-morning, I told Jen Stewart to send out the directive as I picked up the phone to give Meadows a heads up. His assistant answered the phone but said he was in another meeting and couldn't be interrupted. I told her why I was calling and that she should interrupt and give him a note. With that, I hung up. The directive sent throughout the DOD began by restating our mission, duty to the nation, and that which unifies us. Our sworn oath to the Constitution and our shared duty to defend the nation. The memo reaffirmed the American flag as our principal symbol for display. Yet it also authorized the flying of 9 other categories of flags, such as state flags, the POW/MIA flag, unit flags, and the flags of organizations of which the United States is a member, for example, NATO. There was no mention of the Confederate flag. The guidance memo applied to public displays or depictions of flags by service members and civilian employees in all DOD workplaces, common access areas, and public areas, including several specific areas. I closed the memo with the same words I used often regarding this issue. What has always united us remains clear. Our common mission, our oath to support and defend the Constitution, and our American flag. With this change in policy, we will further improve the morale, cohesion, and readiness of the force in defense of our great nation. Trump was furious as news of my policy change became public. It was not lost on me that the president had declined to denounce the Confederate flag when asked about it by the media in recent weeks. He viewed it as a freedom of speech issue that government should protect. In sending out my memo, I wasn't trying to pick a fight with the president or violate someone's First Amendment rights. But in the military, those constitutional rights sometimes must take a back seat to good order and discipline, as well as the readiness of the force, and that was my focus. My friends close to the White House said that while Trump was angry, he wasn't going to fire me. His own re-election still took priority over his desire for retribution. A lot of people, they said, didn't understand why Mattis left over the withdrawal of several hundred troops from Syria, a place most Americans couldn't find on a map, and didn't understand why our troops were there in the first place. But firing Esper because he banned Confederate flags or refused to send active duty troops into American cities would backfire horribly. Trump eventually calmed down, but our relationship was even more frayed, and everyone knew it. I wasn't hiding my disaffection either. On July 7th, I recorded a message to the force thanking them and highlighting all of the progress we had made over the previous year when it came to implementing the National Defense Strategy and dealing with the challenges the world threw at us. From conflict with Iran and confrontation with China, to the greatest civil unrest the country had seen in decades, and a global pandemic the world hadn't experienced in 100 years. As one news story would astutely report after the fact, there may be no bigger hint of the strains at play than what Esper is not saying. When he recorded a 10-minute video for troops largely touting his accomplishments and thanking the force, he didn't mention the commander-in-chief once. As expected, dozens of lawmakers would write me in the weeks that followed, pressing me to allow an exception for LGBTQ pride flags. I had no personal issue with the pride flag, but we had to draw a clear line somewhere. A year later, many of these same lawmakers and outside advocacy groups would urge the Biden administration to reverse my policy. But to my satisfaction and the new administration's credit, the Biden team defended the policy and refused to make any changes to my July 2020 policy memo. On the other hand, they had unfortunately not yet established the third pillar of my diversity and inclusion agenda, the Permanent and Independent Defense Advisory Committee on Diversity and Inclusion in the Armed Services. No reason had been given. Our work was far from done, though. The diversity and inclusion initiatives were a major step forward, but I still had the daily grind of advancing our agenda. Meetings on nuclear command and control, reform of the Navy, space operations, and an update from my China task force were on the agenda for the second half of July. These were the best parts of the job. Finally, Mike Pompeo and I also had an annual 2+2 meeting with our Australian counterparts at the end of the month. The main topic would be China, a topic that was occupying more and more of our attention, for very important reasons. Chapter 19. China, China, China. The vote on the Senate floor wasn't close. Senators Fred Thompson, Republican from Tennessee, and Robert Torricelli, Democrat from New Jersey, offered a simple bipartisan amendment to the China trade bill that would have imposed sanctions on Chinese companies that traffic in nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons systems and components, as well as long-range missiles, selling them to countries such as North Korea and Iran. The last remaining hurdle to a trade bill that would ease China's entry into the World Trade Organization, WTO, failed by 65 votes. It was September 14, 2000. For years, the United States reached out to China, established formal diplomatic relations in 1979, assisted Beijing's development, and worked to integrate the nation of 1.4 billion people out of isolation and poverty and into the global community of nations where it could prosper and grow. The crowning achievement of this period was China's entry into the WTO in 2001. The U.S. policy wasn't completely altruistic, and not everyone supported this approach. On an economic level, getting China into the WTO and compliant with the established rules of international trade meant that an enormous market would be opened to American businesses. This would mean economic growth for the United States and jobs for Americans. Many in the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, however, viewed the WTO rules as too unfair, the conditions for joining too harsh, the economic liberalization required too fast, and the transparency rules too onerous. Many Chinese simply didn't like the fact that they were joining a system they didn't help construct. On a political level, many in the United States believed that economic openness would be the engine that drove liberalization in China. The argument was that as the Chinese people prospered and their standard of living improved, they would press for political reform that would inevitably lead to democratization. This theory, promulgated in initiatives like China's admission to the WTO, had overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress. It was pushed by Republican and Democrat administrations alike. It enjoyed the advocacy of big business, organized labor, and farmers, and it was endorsed by a bevy of other groups. But not everyone was convinced. A bipartisan minority on Capitol Hill took a more skeptical view. I was working for Fred Thompson at the time, handling China and all his defense and foreign policy issues. In the months leading up to the Senate vote, he argued that the prevailing theory was too simple and too Pollyannish. If we got it wrong and the CCP remained in power, we could end up selling them the means of our own undoing. Thompson and others who expressed deep concern about China pointed to Beijing's human rights record, their suppression of the media and religious groups, threats toward Taiwan, and other reasons that lawmakers should be careful about buying completely into the China liberalization theory. The optimistic view was so strong and so prevalent, however, that a majority of senators defeated the common-sense national security amendment sponsored by Thompson and Torricelli. Not surprisingly, the broad range of concerns expressed by Thompson and other senators 2 decades ago are still with us today, and are more disconcerting than ever. The China liberalization theory was a failure, as have been our broader efforts to change the CCP's policies and behavior. An important accomplishment of the Trump administration was its consolidation within the U.S. government of a clear-eyed view that the People's Republic of China, PRC, was not a friendly, benign country, but a strategic competitor and growing adversary, determined to supplant the United States as the global leader and eager to reshape the international rules, laws, and order in its favor. This new consensus regarding China marked a seismic shift in U.S. policy, certainly signaling a dramatic change from the post-9/11 order. This is the lens through which the administration developed its policies, processes, and messaging toward China. The administration was also able to focus a growing number of our European allies on the rising threat and challenges that the CCP presented. Nowhere was this more obvious than in the meeting halls of NATO, or in the statements issued by the alliance from 2017 through 2020, where an emphasis was placed on China and specific issues such as Huawei and 5G. The same was true for our efforts to bring together the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, known as the Quad, the grouping of the 4 like-minded democracies of Australia, Japan, India, and the United States. These things wouldn't have happened without the continued push by Washington. Some critics would say that the Trump administration had no coherent strategy when it came to China. That was unfair and untrue. We had one, and the will to implement it. The president, however, was not inclined to follow it. Indeed, on January 15, 2020, at the signing of the Phase 1 trade deal with China, just days before the first COVID case in America would be identified, the president said, "We have a great relationship with China, the best it's ever been." It wasn't until later, the final 10 months of his administration, once it became clear that COVID was undermining his re-election chances and the global view congealed that China shouldered much of the blame for the pandemic's explosion, that Trump took a hard line toward Beijing on matters other than trade. Otherwise, Trump was one-dimensional when it came to the PRC. For him, the relationship seemed wholly about the trade imbalance and unfair Chinese trade practices, and even then, these matters appeared subordinate to his relationship with Xi Jinping, the autocratic Chinese leader who was taking the PRC in a dark direction. Fortunately, the departments and agencies had been generally following the formal game plan since it was published and had the right people in place to make it happen. In 2017, the NSC, under H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, and Matt Pottinger, the Asia Director at the Council who led these efforts, produced 2 documents, the U.S. Strategic Framework for the Indo-Pacific and the U.S. Strategic Framework for Countering China's Economic Aggression, that laid out a whole-of-government approach to China. That December of 2017, the National Security Strategy was published. The strategy made clear that China and Russia, under its Communist Party, was a revisionist power that aimed to shape a world antithetical to U.S. values and interests and displace the United States in the Indo-Pacific region, expand the reaches of its state-driven economic model, and reorder the region in its favor. I was not new to the China portfolio and the broader challenges in the Indo-Pacific theater. My last active duty assignment in the Army was as the U.S. Pacific Command War Planner on the Army staff at the Pentagon in 1995 and 1996. In this role, I had responsibility for helping develop, coordinate, and integrate U.S. Army forces and resources required for conflict in the region, with a focus on North Korea and Taiwan at the time. During my time with Senator Thompson, I did a lot of work on China-related issues, from weapons of mass destruction, WMD, proliferation, and the Chinese military buildup, to technology theft and espionage against the United States. When I moved to take over the national security portfolio on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I took this basket of issues with me. And during my time on the Hill, I had the opportunity to travel to Beijing on several occasions, meet with the PRC's leaders, and to visit our allies in the region, including Taiwan. I would carry this work forward to my time as policy director for the House Armed Services Committee as well. It was during this period, in the early 2000s, that the small group of us who spent a lot of time on China and related issues sensed a shift underway. Members' views toward China were improving at the expense of Taiwan, accompanied by what seemed to be a dramatic increase in Chinese embassy personnel and their lobbyists trolling the halls of Congress. It appeared as if Beijing finally figured out how to play the DC game. When I was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Negotiations Policy at the Pentagon from 2002 to 2004, my portfolio included all arms control, non-proliferation, and a broad range of international issues for the DoD. I ended up working a variety of WMD and conventional proliferation matters linked to China, since Beijing was a major trafficker in these items. I returned to the Hill in 2004 to become the National Security Advisor to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, Republican from Tennessee, which was probably the best job in Congress for someone who thrives on defense and foreign policy issues and their intersection with politics at the highest level. Despite a significant focus on Afghanistan and Iraq at the time, China was still a topic that garnered a good deal of attention. In 2007, a year after I left Capitol Hill, Mitch McConnell, who had succeeded Frist as the Republican leader in the Senate, appointed me to serve as a commissioner on the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. The commission, which was in a rebuilding mode, included a number of sharp people from both sides of the political aisle, as well as from such key sectors as defense, trade, human rights, and technology. It was a good time to delve deeper into the U.S.-China relationship and the issues facing our country from Beijing. I never considered myself a China expert, but by the end of my tour on the commission, I was confident enough to co-teach a graduate course on U.S.-China relations at Missouri State University in Northern Virginia with Randy Shriver, who later became my Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs. About the time my tenure on the commission ended, I went to work at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, where I served concurrently as the Executive Vice President for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Global Intellectual Property Center and as Vice President for Europe and Eurasia. As the Intellectual Property Center head, I had a front-row seat at how China was stealing U.S. ideas, innovations, and all forms of intellectual property on a grand scale. It was devastating to the economy, to companies large and small, and to tens of thousands of U.S. workers. It seemed as if no industry was unaffected, with the cost estimated at between $225 billion and $600 billion annually. Yet, despite all this theft and other coercive rules Beijing was imposing on many American businesses operating in China, most companies during that first decade of the 2000s still seemed willing to tolerate this bad behavior. The lure of 1.4 billion consumers remained hypnotic. By the time Trump entered office in 2017, a major shift was underway. Nearly all the key sectors and industries that were fully behind China in 2000 had or were changing their position and their outlook. This transition accelerated after Xi Jinping became General Secretary of the CCP in 2012 and began taking the PRC in a far more autocratic direction. The false promise of political reform disappeared as Xi, usually referred to as President Xi in Western media, implemented an anti-corruption campaign that led to the downfall of many Communist Party officials and instituted stern measures to improve internal party discipline and authority. Xi also oversaw a buildup of China's armed forces and the development of a more aggressive foreign policy that bullied neighbors, made illegal territorial claims in the South and East China Seas, and used foreign debt as a tool to gain access and influence around the globe. In 2020 alone, a Chinese ship rammed into and sank a Vietnamese fishing vessel with 8 persons aboard, an incident similar to one perpetrated against Filipino fishermen the year before. Armed Chinese Coast Guard ships routinely escorted Chinese fishing fleets into the exclusive economic zones of Indonesia and the Philippines. And Beijing continued deploying its maritime militia around the Spratly Islands. Meanwhile, the PRC's development and militarization of several geographic features in the waters of the South China Sea were not only illegal and provocative, but broke a personal promise Xi made to President Obama in 2015. Through its Belt and Road Initiative, China is expanding its financial ties across Asia, Europe, Africa, and the Americas, with the ulterior motive of gaining strategic influence, access to key resources, and military footholds around the world. China's first overseas base is in Djibouti on the east coast of Africa, and the Chinese are actively working to establish more bases from there across the Indian Ocean, and then eastward back toward Beijing. Worse, the PRC is expanding its power at the expense of others' sovereignty. And the smaller the nation is, the heavier the hand from Beijing. Many China watchers consider Xi an authoritarian leader for clamping down on freedoms, ignoring human rights, and removing term limits on his presidency. That was my perspective as well. As Xi's grip on power tightened and his direction became clearer, fewer and fewer leaders in the United States had much reason to believe the PRC would change its ways. In fact, China's behavior was getting worse. The China liberalization theory was rapidly collapsing. Most alarming for the DOD was the incredible growth in the capability of the People's Liberation Army, PLA, since 2000. Accelerated by Xi's 2017 goal for the PLA to become a world-class military by the end of 2049, the 100th anniversary of the founding of the PRC. The Pentagon largely interpreted this objective to mean that Beijing wanted to develop a military by mid-century that is equal to, or in some cases superior to, the U.S. military, or that of any other great power that the PRC views as a threat. To achieve this end, the CCP committed the people, budget, technology, and disciplined strategic focus to build conventional weaponry in the air, sea, and land domains, to develop asymmetric space and cyberspace capabilities, and to both modernize and expand its nuclear forces. The PRC's midterm objective is to complete its military modernization by 2035. Double-digit annual percentage increases over many years in the PLA's budget epitomized this effort. To meet their 2049 goal, China is also working hard to make their military a more professional force, one that employs modern operational concepts, is structured to be more suitable for joint and combined arms operations, and has a larger overseas military footprint. The Trump administration's approach toward China didn't begin nearly as strongly as it finished, however. The publication of the National Security Strategy, NSS, in December 2017 was an important first step in setting the background, tone, and direction of the administration with regard to China. The more important document for the Pentagon was its National Defense Strategy, NDS, which translated the NSS into the guidance the DOD needed for military planning, force development, modernization, operational adjustments, training and exercises, global presence, alliance building, and other important defense and warfighting constructs. As I've mentioned before, I made implementing the NDS my top priority beginning on my first day. The first of two challenges I faced in doing so was re-empowering OSD civilians to take charge of strategy operationalization and implementation, as discussed earlier. John Rood, and later James Anderson, my policy leads, understood this, and as supporters of the NDS and civilian control, they were more than willing to take the reins. The second challenge was the four-star combatant commanders, and mostly the geographic commands as opposed to the functional ones. Some often read the strategy to suit their respective ends. The top-tier countries were China and Russia, but I clearly put the PRC as number one. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, Indo-PACOM, for example, thought they should get more resources, despite already having the preponderance of assets, since China was in their area of responsibility. Africa Command, on the other hand, worked hard to reframe several of its missions as global power competition activities, despite the command being designated earlier as an economy of force theater from which resources were to be taken. Central Command was stuck in the middle. Russia and China had a growing presence in their region, but they clamored for more resources based on ongoing operations in Afghanistan and Syria, rocket attacks in Iraq, and potential conflict with Iran. The fact was, great power competition with China and Russia was indeed global in nature, which meant that we couldn't put all our eggs in one basket or take them all out of another. We needed to make some tough decisions on how, when, and why to reallocate resources and forces between those baskets, though, which meant reducing mission scope, eliminating lower priority tasks, and consolidating resources, while being willing to accept more risk and uncertainty in some places.